Thanks, Michael, and thanks to CEDA for the opportunity to come along and talk today. And thanks also to Jeff and Brad for opening up the complexities of what is an enormously complex and challenging issue. If you look at the lineup of speakers for today, it's pretty clear that I'm here to talk about it from an industry and energy users viewpoint. Obviously, any debate which talks about carbon costs, climate change response, emissions trading, the people that use energy, the industries that use energy, are the ones that are likely to face the increased costs, and there'll be an issue there of whether those costs can be passed on. I'm actually going to borrow a bit from Jeff here and actually start off by going back to some of the principles about what it is we're trying to do, and then to look, when we look at what we're trying to do, look at some of the things that might inadvertently happen along the way. So this chart is a chart of the global emissions of carbon dioxide equivalent. This is what the scientists are telling us is causing climate change. This is what we've got to reduce if we're going to resolve climate change. Now, you can see that the emissions are already at a very high level and that they are rising at quite a rapid rate. Now, I've put an arrow on there to describe, of those emissions, which part of it belong to countries which are countries with a Kyoto target. So this area up here are countries that have a target under the Kyoto Protocol, and the emissions in this band here are countries that don't have a target under the Kyoto Protocol. So a few things become sort of immediately obvious, and that is that the increase in emissions is happening as much or more so in countries that don't have a Kyoto target, and those countries that don't have a Kyoto target, the developing countries, already represent a sizable proportion of the world's emissions. Now, if we look at where the scientists are telling us we've got to get emissions to address the problem of climate change, there was reference earlier to the idea of getting it to the level of 450 to 500 parts per million. To achieve that sort of level, we need to reduce global emissions down to this sort of point here. Now, again, a few things become immediately obvious, and they've been brought up by some of the other speakers. If we're going to achieve those sorts of levels, we have to get a dramatic turnaround in the rate of global emissions, and that turnaround in emissions has to occur in all countries across the globe. You can see from where the non-Kyoto countries are now to where we're trying to get to, this is clearly not going to be done just by Kyoto countries taking action. There needs to be a global solution to this problem because it is a global issue. The other thing that hopefully has leaped out at you from that graph is the role that Australia has in the global thing. Australia is this thin, light-coloured band along the top there. Now, that's got a lot of important implications. The obvious one is that it really doesn't matter what Australia does to reduce its emissions. That by itself is going to be a trivial amount in terms of reaching the global target that we have. A lot of the current debate is pitched on terms of whether Australia should have a 5% reduction or a 15% reduction or a 40% reduction, and whether we should start this scheme now or in a year's time or in 2 years' time. I think you can see from that graph that it wouldn't really matter whether Australia started this year or in 2 years' time, and it wouldn't matter whether Australia has a 5% reduction or a 40% reduction. None of those permutations are going to do much to address the global problem we've got. That's not to say we don't have an important role in this process, but I'd suggest to you that the role Australia has in this process is to demonstrate that emissions can be reduced without crippling your economy. That's the role that has to be put forward here, because if it can't be shown that emissions can be reduced without damaging your economy, then the world has no hope of bringing these other countries on board to reducing their emissions. The most important role for Australia in this process is not to reduce our emissions by 15% or 20%, but to demonstrate that reducing emissions is compatible with growth in the economy. Now, I'd like to move... Sorry, one final point I'll make on the international, and Jeff brought this out quite strongly, was that unlike issues like trade liberalisation and tax treatment, there's an important difference here when it comes to global climate change policy. There is no advantage in moving first. So in trade liberalisation, the country's economy benefits if you liberalise trade ahead of other countries. When it comes to emissions reductions and imposing costs on your own economy, there is no first mover advantage. So the diabolical problem that's been set up here is that we need all countries to take action, but the countries that take action initially are the ones that will wear the greatest cost of what happens. That's what makes this issue so complex and so difficult at an international level, and it's also what makes it so important at a domestic level that when we do take action, we consider what the impacts will be on competitiveness. So I'd like to look at what those impacts are on the competitiveness of Australian businesses. Now, I'm going to talk through a global cost curve. This is a generic one. There's no real data in here, and I'm coming at this from an aluminium perspective, but it would apply equally to a whole bunch of other industries. If you look at the global production of any commodity and the cost of producing it in various facilities around the world, you can construct a global cost curve where the lowest cost producers are down the bottom left-hand side, and the highest cost producers are in the top right-hand side. Now, at a certain point in time, those producers may all be making a profit, but their rates of profit vary greatly. The next thing to do is to look at, you can arrange that cost curve into quartiles. The first quartile are obviously the lowest cost producers. It's where the profits are most healthy, where the viability is strongest, and it's also where global companies will tend to make investments when they're looking to expand their operations. So if you're going to build a new facility somewhere in the world, you're going to build it somewhere where it can come in at that bottom end of the cost curve. The second quartile of the cost curve is still a very profitable operation, still viable. The companies that own those sorts of operations will be looking to reinvest in those facilities to keep them down the bottom end of the cost curve. So at the second quartile, you can keep investing and keep yourself as a viable operation. Once you get to the third quartile of the cost curve, you're starting to get into dangerous areas there. To bring a third quartile operation down to a low-cost producer in the world, you'd have to make a substantial investment in that facility, perhaps, you know, markedly increase its production levels, change the technology. It would be a significant investment. And at that point, you start to draw yourself into a comparison. Are you better off building a whole new facility than investing in the large scale on the third quartile? Once you get to the fourth quartile of an operation, you're really in the death zone. While the price of the commodity is high enough for that to be profitable and to turn a cash profit, that facility will keep going. When the price drops, that facility will be the first one closed within global operations. Now, why is all that relevant? Well, if you look at our industry, the aluminium and alumina industry, the operations in Australia at the moment occur usually at the top end of the first quartile or the bottom end of the second quartile of global operations. They're competitive operations, they're low-cost producers. The owners of those facilities, and their global owners, are looking to reinvest in those facilities to keep them at the bottom end of the cost curve. When the government brings in and imposes something like an emissions trading scheme, the CPRS, and a renewable energy target, the key thing about these policies is that they only increase the cost of Australian producers. They don't increase the cost of any other producers on that global cost curve. So it takes an Australian operation and it adds extra cost to the top of an Australian operation. Let me just get it to me. You can pretty much see what happens when that happens. You shift that operation up the cost curve. You take it from where it is and it has to shift somewhere to the right-hand side on that cost curve. And the question is how far up that cost curve it shifts. The analysis we've done for our industry is that the current proposals for the carbon pollution reduction scheme and the renewable energy target are significant enough that they would move an operation from the boundary between the first and second quartile to the boundary between the third and fourth quartile. The costs are significant enough that they'll move Australian operations two quartiles up in the global cost curve. Going back to what the impact of those quartiles is, the significance of that is it takes these facilities from one that you would grow and invest in to a facility that you'll curtail when the price drops and will be one of the first facilities shut on a global scale. Now, we hear a lot of talk about carbon leakage and a lot of criticism of the idea of carbon leakage, that no one's going to pick up these operations and carry them overseas and put them elsewhere. That's not how carbon leakage occurs. This is how carbon leakage occurs. You reduce the attractiveness of reinvesting in Australian facilities. As a result of not reinvesting in those facilities, they drift up the cost curve and eventually at some point, due to market forces, they'll close. So what happens is, as the price drops, the curtailment and the ceasing of operations occurs in the fourth quartile. When the market comes back, you rebuild a new plant in the first quartile. So the leakage hasn't occurred immediately after the policy was brought in, but it was an inevitable result of increasing costs in Australian operations and not increasing them elsewhere. So with that background, what view would the aluminium industry take to the sort of two proposals that were being canvassed this morning? The consumption carbon tax type model and the emissions trading scheme model, noting that Brad wasn't backing the government CPRS model. As an industry, we're a significant player in global markets. Australia is the largest producer of alumina, the largest producer of bauxite, and the fifth largest producer of aluminium. It employs 17,000 people in Australia. 80% of the production is exported, earning $11 billion in exports. This is an industry where Australia has a competitive advantage. We're not looking for government support in order to be able to sustain the industry. It's an industry that competes globally in its own right in Australia. As a result of having good natural resources in the form of bauxite, competitive energy supplies, skilled workforce, competitive supply chains, this is an industry where we could be looking for significant growth in Australia. Now, clearly, the consumption model that was described by Jeff deals with a lot of those international competition concerns. that I outlined. So if you go back to this graph, if you look at the consumption model being described by Jeff, these costs would only be imposed on product that's being sold into the Australian market, and other products being sold into the Australian market from other operations would face a similar size cost. So the global cost curve in the context of the Australian market would all move up evenly. In an export market, these costs would not be imposed on Australian production if it's being exported, so the global cost curve wouldn't change in an export market. So from the point of view of an industry that's competing in international markets, it's a clear winner to a consumption model compared to a production model when it comes to imposing a carbon cost. When it comes to the question of whether you'd be more interested in an emissions trading scheme or a tax, I think the answer is less clear. You're really faced with a devil's choice there as to whether you want to hand money over to the government and trust that the government will be rational and efficient in the way it spends that money, or whether you want to be involved in a market which includes a lot of middlemen and trading in derivatives and trading in hedge funds. It's a bit, as I say, a devil's choice, but I suspect that most industry would pump for a market-based system rather than a tax-based system. And the final point I'd like to make in the comparison of the two systems is that a lot of the complexity comes from translating the theory into practice. So when we were talking about the theory of emissions trading a number of years ago, it seemed like a pretty sensible model to take, and most of the difficulties have come as we've delved into the detail of that and tried to work out the detail. Now, a consumption-based model, a consumption tax, a carbon tax, looks very good at a theoretical level, and I think for the reasons I've described, it's probably a better outcome from Australian industry's viewpoint, but you don't want to underestimate the complexity and challenges and difficulties that you would run into as you develop the detail of that policy over time. So as a concluding comment, I guess I'd like to go back to making that point about the international context. The challenge of what we've got to do with the Australian policy is to come up with a way of reducing emissions that does not cripple the economy. Now on that front, the government CPRS proposal is a bad outcome. A carbon tax type model, as outlined by Jeff, could well be a better outcome, but there's plenty of detail to be developed. And I also take the points that Brad was making about some of the pragmatism that's there in emissions trading. I suspect the right outcome from an industry point of view, given how far down the path we are, is to make some fundamental amendments to the emissions trading model. Thanks.